Welcome, everybody, to Between the Lines, a podcast produced by the Louis Jacobs Foundation and committed to Rabbi Jacobs's belief that the quest for Torah is indeed Torah itself. My name is Simon Eder, and each week I'm joined by a special guest who helps us to deconstruct that week's parsha, exploring new paths on the quest for Torah. It is wonderful to be joined today by Rabbi James Jacobson Meisels, who directs and is founder of the vision of Or HaLev. Rabbi Meisels was ordained by Rav Daniel Landis with a doctorate in Jewish studies from the University of Chicago. He's been studying and teaching meditation and Jewish spirituality for over 25 years. He's the founder and Rosh Yeshiva of the Romamu Yeshiva and has taught innovative programs in Jewish thought, mysticism, spiritual practices, and meditation, also at the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies and also at Haifa University, Yeshivat Hadar, and in a variety of settings really right across the Jewish world. So it is truly wonderful to have you with us today. As we explore this week the parasha of Vayakel, and maybe to begin, I really wonder your take on the role of the Mishkan in the lives of the Israelites that caused them to respond so generously.
The Mishkan is a very special moment in Jewish history. It's a moment that only lasts for a certain amount of time, but Israelites as a people have this relationship with the divine, with Hashem. That happens in Egypt. We don't know that much about really what the relationship is like in Egypt until Moshe comes back and we start to have the beginnings of the Exodus and the plagues. And in that experience, there's a divine which brings these devastating plagues on Egypt. The Israelites themselves are scared of this process. They eventually leave the desert. They get eventually to Mount Sinai. Revelation happens. They are told to stand far away and not get too near the mountain. There's thunder, there's lightning. Even that's too much for them. So there's a really transcendent, powerful, extraordinary divinity that they're encountering there. And then in the desert, they're told to build the Mishkan. It says, Basulu Mishkan v'shachanti b'tocham. Make for me a Mishkan, and I will dwell literally within you. So it doesn't say I will dwell within the Mishkan, but I will dwell within you. That the Mishkan is this vessel for bringing the divine presence directly into the experience of the Israelites, in a certain sense, but really inside the Israelites, that the divine can be in them, that the divine will be intimate and close with them. And so this is a whole new stage in the relationship, I think, of the Israelites with the divine, not the divine up there on the mountain, far away, terrifying perhaps in some ways, but a divine who's right here inside of me, present with me, the Mishkan itself, which is inside the camp, totally present, totally available in a certain ways. Anybody who's walking around the camp can see it. It's right there. The divine is present there. And in a way that's moving with us, right? The Mishkan moves with the Israelites as they move. So it stays with them both in a very physical sense and also with them in an internal sense, which is different from eventually it'll become the Mikdash, the temple in Jerusalem, which then is just in Jerusalem. If you're Jerusalem, maybe you're somewhat close, but it's hard to get too near. And you're living in other parts of Israel and you're far away, right? So this is a unique moment of this real intimacy of the divine.
That's maybe a good segue to really asking about how the Mishkan represents a kind of evolution in the people's relationship with the divine, and maybe grateful for your tracing how that relationship has evolved throughout the book of Shemot. It's obviously very different at the beginning to the end.
Yeah, we'll say even not even the book of Shemot, but even back to Breshit, in the before there are Israelites, in a certain sense, there's a very intimate, almost human relationship with the divine. The Avot talk to the divine, there's conversations, they get into trouble, they get out of trouble with the divine, right? There's a sort of almost familial relationship, and that is the familiar part of the story. It's a story of a family, right? It's Shemot, of course, is when we really become a nation, from a family, right? We make that transition to being a nation. And then you get this new national relationship, which is a different kind of relationship. As we just described it, that relationship, we don't know the full story of the many years that the Israelites live in Egypt. We don't have much information on what that looks like. But once we get to the time period of slavery, the Israelites are severely oppressed, in great pain, feeling quite lost and not very confident. And when they start to get exposed to the divine, it's a divine that is maybe going to bring them to freedom, but it also has a lot of questions. Moshe and Moses and Aaron show up, and the Israelites aren't exactly sure how to take this. And are they just going to cause more trouble, or are they actually going to bring them free? And then, as I just described, we have this movement from this really sort of transcendent, powerful divine to the movement into the Mishkan of the divine, which is really close by us, which is hanging out with us in a certain way. There's a beautiful Hasidic teaching, not actually a lot around the Mishkan itself, but around the nature of exile. What's the difference? So we go through the Mishkan, we get to the land of Israel, we have the temple, right? There's this sort of set place to be. And Hasidic masters say, when you're in exile and you're traveling, it's like a king. When a king's in his palace, it's hard to see the king, right? There's all kinds of people and ministers and any famous important person. But when the king's on the road, he just needs to stop somewhere and your house is closest. So he stops and he says, hey, can I sleep at your house? As it was then. And then all of a sudden you're intimate and close to the king. And there's this similar sense with the Mishkan. It's like we're traveling, we're on the path, we're not there yet, we're in between. And so in that in-between place, there is all of a sudden an intimacy that develops in that relationship. No longer a familial intimacy. It's not like a member of the family, but it's a kind of this powerful and transcendent divine becomes close and imminent with us rather than transcendent. And I think this model of the Mishkan happens for a certain moment of Jewish history, but it's a model which then continues to accompany us throughout history. Every time we turn towards this aspect of intimacy and imminence rather than transcendence and distance, both important aspects of human-divine relationship.
I wonder, maybe might you comment on that a little further? Of course, the Midrash and the Kabbalistic literature refer to the Mishkan as a place of intimacy. How do you maybe expand on that?
The Midrash and the Kabbalistic literature really take this beautiful, rather radical turn where they say the Mishkan is, of course, a place of intimacy. It's a place of presence, of imminence, but they take that intimacy a step further to really highlight the erotic nature of the Mishkan, the nature of a relationship with the divine, which is not just intimate in the sense of God is here, or God is a friend, or God is inside of me, but that God is my lover, right? And that we are somehow lovers of the divine. This is expressed in many ways. We have two verses, one in Exodus and one in Numbers. One says, Vayechal Moshe et Malacha, and Moshe finished, Vayechal, the work of the Mishkan. And another verse in Numbers, it says, Kalot Moshe lakim et Mishkan, Vayi v'yom kalot Moshe, in the day which kalot, Moshe finished the Mishkan, kalot. But the Midrash takes these words, Vayechal, which are from the same root, and says they're the same word as kala, bride, right? And so what it really means to finish the Mishkan is that in some ways we become the bride of the divine, or the bride becomes the bride of us, and we become the groom of the divine, or whatever that relationship looks like, right? So that's quite a powerful moment. It's saying, oh, actually, there's a profound intimacy here, which is at erotic and loving level. And then the Talmud takes it actually even deeper, even more explicit in some ways. They talk about how the Kruvim, the cherubs, which are on the ark, that at certain moments when we would come into presence of the cherubs, we could see that they were actually clinging to each other in erotic embrace. Right? So the cherubs themselves were like a symbol of love and togetherness, and seeing how beloved we are, and that symbol of really being in erotic relationship with the divine. In another part of the Talmud, in a similar part, but discussing this, they talk about all the beautiful aspects of the Mishkan, the staves and the curtains and all different things. And we can think of them as a kind of adornments of the Shekhinah, the presence of the divine. Of course, the Shekhinah, the divine presence, is just the sense of the divine being present, that immanence, which we talked about already. But in the Kabbalistic imagination, that becomes also the divine feminine, which is an erotic relationship with other aspects of the divine and of humans. And indeed, in one part of the Talmud, they talk about how the staves of the ark pushed out, and this is likened to the way we can see different parts of the body of a lover underneath their clothes, right? Like we would notice different parts of our lover's body underneath their clothes. And the same thing is said in the Mishkan. So there's quite a kind of radical reading of this sense of love and desire and connection and passion between us and divine, which is another aspect of our relationship, one which maybe in the biblical imagination is really expressed most in Shir HaShirim in the Song of Songs. But I think also as part of that erotic nature, there's, as we can imagine, lying with a lover in bed. The Mishkan is a divine bedroom. That sort of tenderness and care and love, maybe hugging each other, right? It doesn't have to be the moment of Eros itself, but it can just be that intimacy of togetherness, of touch, of contact, of skin on skin, of really being close with and together with the divine in a way which is deeply healing and connecting. And that's really a gorgeous and beautiful, I think, aspect of a relationship, which maybe we don't think about as much as we could have, and certainly plays a central role in our tradition. That aspect, what does it mean to relate to the divine as a lover, as somebody who can accompany me in care and compassion and intimacy and closeness, somebody I can have passion to, somebody who there can be pleasure and embrace and contact with? And how does that expand and shift my relationship with the divine when I look at it that way?
Truly radical way of thinking about it. And thank you for bringing that potential aspect, for sure. I wonder how you might interpret this from chapter 35:5, where we read, "Take from yourselves an offering to God, all the generous of heart." How is that maybe important to the people's transformed relationship with the divine?
Oh, it's a very interesting verse that verse. It says, the Pasuk says, Ku mi me'itchem truma. So it could have just said, Ku truma, take a truma, take some offering, take some thing you want to offer. Everybody would understand it. It would be very clear. So what, as we always want to ask in when we're looking at the Torah, what's the significance of each word? So why does it say take from you? What's the from you there? Obviously, if you're giving something, it's yours, right? So what's the from you? And I think the verse is talking to us about what does it mean to really take from ourselves. This might be an object. This might be an object. And certainly people give objects to the Mishkan. But people also give lots of other stuff, right? People give their school skills, their talents, their wisdom, their experience. The most famous example of it is Bezalel, right? Who's the famous craftsman and artist who was able to make the Mishkan come into being. But we have people who are sewing and creating different aspects of the Mishkan and bringing them together. And so we're really being asked, much like you would ask of a lover, it's give of yourself. Giving of yourself might also just be sharing something intimate. It might be sharing a vulnerability. I think we've all experienced that in relationships. All of a sudden, we share a vulnerability with something that really is a kind of offering a gift to the other person, which they can then return with their own vulnerability. And all of a sudden, a kind of closeness and deepness and depth to our contact has developed through that moment of gift giving, through that moment of offering, which is really comes from a generosity of heart, because I want to deepen this relationship. I want to be in a more profound relationship with you. And so this giving is both just an offering to make the Mishkan possible, certainly that. This is how we're going to make the divine be able to be imminent with us. But it's also a kind of natural generosity of intimacy, which then develops and deepens that intimacy, right? It strengthens the relationship, just as we all do in any of our relationships when we give ourselves. And I think it's helpful for us to ask in that context what that might look like for me. We're not building the literal Mishkan anymore. That's not the stage of history we're in, but we're still very much building this Mishkan all the time in our communities, in our families, in my own personal life. How do I build a place where the divine can be present for me? And how central is the giving of myself and the generosity? The generosity, says everyone who has a generous heart. And this notion repeats itself a few times. So, what is my heart moving me to offer? What is it offering here that might be of service to the presence of divinity? How might, in any situation, but maybe particularly in a challenging situation, how might I make the divine presence in this moment? One thing I think we forget sometimes, or maybe don't want to read the Torah because we see it so clearly. When the Israelites are in the desert, they are freaked out most of the time. They're like scared. They're worried, are we going to be okay? They've seen these amazing plagues and all these miracles and stuff, but it's not enough. They're like, is there going to be food? Is there going to be water? Maybe we should go back to Egypt. It was better there. I mean, the Jewish complaint ethos we see in a very ancient way as we leave and are in the desert. And so there's really this sense of struggle, of challenge, of uncertainty, of instability, which I think all of us in the Jewish world can identify with very deeply right now. This sense of instability, of not knowing where we are, what's happening next. Are we going to be safe? Can we rely on the future? What does the future look like? These are, I think, are profound questions. They're questions which are always present in human life, but they're present for us now in a newly acute way, I think, across the Jewish world. And they were present for the Israelites in the desert in a newly acute way. In Egypt, it was terrible, but at least they knew what it was. And they said that you knew what was going to happen. It was orderly, right? The desert was completely unknown. What's going to happen? How long is this going to take? We don't know what's happening. We don't have any context. We don't have anything reliable, totally unstable, totally uncertain. And I want to take it for myself, at least, as a really invitation to say, okay, you are in the desert right now. That's what it feels like. We're in the desert. You do not know what's happening. What can heal that? What can make presence possible? What can make divine presence possible right here? Perhaps it's giving of myself. Perhaps it's generosity. Perhaps it's touching into my heart and seeing what can I offer to my community, family, people, the world, that might create some sense of presence and connection. That, and this is, I think, part of the Mishkan, it can give us a sense of safety and connection, even in the midst of uncertainty. The Mishkan keeps moving. It's not the Mikdash yet. It's not like we've gotten to the place and we're there, we're home, we're settled. We're not settled. We're going to keep packing it up and breaking it apart. But even in the midst of that continued uncertainty, there's a kind of stability and presence that it can offer.
Thank you for drawing so many wonderful and important connections. I maybe wonder whether finally you might dwell a little further on that connection between the Mishkan and the heart. And what can we draw really from that, and particularly in our troubled world today?
Yeah, in the Mishkan, we start with this verse, Vasuli Mikdash Veshachanti B'tocham. That the divine will dwell in us. And where does the divine dwell? Where else but in our hearts? So the Kotzker said, the divine will always dwell in our hearts. We just need to let the divine in, right? There's some part of us that's blocking the divine from coming in, that isn't opening the doors. And so the work of the heart is the work of softening ourselves enough, opening ourselves enough. The Pizetzner Rebbe talks about a lot of akut, about softness. Soft heart. He talks about using images which would soften. He says, even a heart of stone, even a heart of stone would be softened by these images. Because when our heart is soft, just starting on a human level, as we all know, when our heart is soft, we are ready to let people in. We're ready to be intimate. We're ready to be connected. When our heart is hard, because it's scared, because it's confused, because it's defensive, then we hold people at a distance. Then we need people to act in a certain way. Then we end up getting into conflict. Then we feel estranged. Then we feel alienated. Then we feel alone. And so this ability to soften our hearts, to really allow the doors of the heart to open, to allow the walls to fall down a little bit and expose ourselves to the other person, I think is one of our most crucial qualities and most crucial invitations that the Mishkan gives us. It's inviting us to really make a dwelling place for the divine. And the divine can't dwell there if the gates are closed. If it's a big wall with battlements and archers and et cetera, who's going to get in? How are we going to have that relationship? But if it's, as the Mishkan was, a tent with flaps that are easily pulled back, for us to be able to walk in and be in the divine presence, then there's something quite extraordinary there. And this sense of the Mishkan, really, as we talked about before, which can accompany us wherever we go. It's not the Mikdash, it's not the temple, which is its own beauty, but which is fixed. It's in one place. You can make pilgrimages to it, that's beautiful, but most of the year, you're going to be far from it. Most of the places you're going to live, you're going to be far from it. With the Mishkan, it's going to be close to you always. It's going to accompany you. As long as you're willing to open the heart, to make the heart available. Again, as the Kotzker said, there's nothing as whole as a broken heart. If we're allowing our heart to break open and really be present with what is true in this moment, then there's a possibility for the divine to dwell in us. We talk about the Shekhinah, as you mentioned before, the original meaning just being the presence of the divine, just the divine literally dwelling, right? Shekhinah, as people might already notice, or might not, is the same root as the word Mishkan, Shachan, to dwell, Mishkon. It's the same word. So Shekhinah is the divine which dwells. It dwells in us, in the world, in the Mishkan. And the Mishkan is the place where the divine dwells. And so we can invite the Shekhinah to be present in us, to really dwell in us, to really, in some Kabbalistic texts, they talk about the Shekhinah as, the English word is going to come to me in a second, it's to soak. The union is going to soak in us. It's going to soak in our reality. It's going to soak in our heart. It's going to, you can have that really immersive sense of soaking. It's like it's going to go into the water. It's going to be there, soaking in us, soaking in our beauty, soaking in our presence. And that's the invitation, which is a quite extraordinary and beautiful invitation. I think for any of us who have touched that sense of the divine, which I'm sure we all have at some point. For some of us, it might have been in some kind of religious practice. For some of us, it might have been on a mountaintop. It might have been in a moment of birth or death. It might have been in a moment of deep connection with another human being. It might have been a moment of dance or song. But there are many ways that happen. We have all these natural moments of connection, of opening, of having the divine feel present within us. And I think what the Mishkan is an invitation to do is really to, in a conscious way, build a dwelling place for the divine. Not just by circumstance, not I went to be Viking and I was on a mountaintop and then boom, it was there. Gorgeous. Love that. What if we could do that in a more regular way, the way the Israelites did, that it could really accompany us in a day-to-day way through our experience. We could build the practice, build the dwelling place so that the divine was with us at all moments or at many moments, or at least at some moments, or at least more moments than it normally is, right? Whatever that looks like. And for me, I'll say in terms of the work we do, that is very much the work we do. We teach Jewish practices of meditation and spirituality really as vessels of techniques of building a Mishkan, of making the divine present for us in a very concrete, non-theoretical way in our life, both in a sense of expansiveness and beauty, but also just in the sense of a loving presence, the presence of a lover who is there holding our hands, who has some warmth and softness, all these things we've been talking about, who accompanies us on our journey to show up in the world with that vulnerability and warmth and softness. And the heart is really the center of that. Our work centers around that place of opening up and softening the heart, because that's what allows the divine to be present. And that's what allows us to be present.
Rabbi Meisels, thank you so much for sharing such wonderful Torah with us today, and also giving us some inkling as to your important work and practices. I believe that in both the UK and the US, you're going to be leading retreats with Hamakom. I wonder if you might share just the details of those, and we'll, of course, post them out as well.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Yeah. So for those of you in the UK or Europe or anywhere close by, from at the end of May, we're having a beautiful retreat, which we're really giving you a chance to start to genuinely open to the kind of experiences we're talking about. It's called Opening to Revelation. It's from May 30th to June 2nd, Thursday to Sunday. And it's really just an opportunity to start to open to really this revelation that the Mishkan provides, that we've just been talking about having the divine be really present with us. And those of you in the US who are willing to travel, Orlev is creating a retreat from Monday, June 3rd to Sunday, June 9th. So a longer week-long retreat outside of LA, which is called Opening the Heart, which again is really directly related to all the things we've been talking about, the way in which we might open and soften our hearts, really meet ourselves, others, the world, and the divine in the fullest, most beautiful way we can. We really welcome you to take us up on any of those offers, and also to join us in any of our classes, other retreats, courses that we offer all the time through our website or orlev.org.
Thank you so much for sharing, and do look forward to seeing people there and continuing the important work. Thank you, everybody, for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast too, please remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. You can find out more about our work at louisjacobs.org and also jewishquest.org. Do tune in again next week as we conclude this year's journey through the book of Shemot. And of course, in subsequent weeks, we continue our wider quest altogether. Rabbi Meisel, thanks so much for today.
Thank you, Simon.